Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Nathaniel Snow, a graduate student of economics at George Mason University, specializing in public choice and law and economics. In addition to pursuing his PhD, which he is preparing feverishly to defend, Mr. Snow has a wide variety of work experiences, including a project manager economist with Criterion Economics, an economist at the U.S. International Trade Commission, where he was the co-author on a project entitled Gazelles and Gazillas in China and India, and in a past life also was a teacher at Agape Corner Border School. He is interested in a wide set of economic questions, including interest rates, abolitionism, subjective time preferences, and religion. He is currently presenting a paper at the Public Choice Society meetings being held in Florida in mid-March of this year entitled Religion Without Romance, Electoral Cycling Within the Evangelical Coalition, An Introduction to Public Choice Political Theology. This work caught my eye, and that is what we will be talking about today. Links, as usual, to cool stuff and junk related to Nathaniel will be found at our website, so check it out. Nathaniel, welcome to Research on Religion.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
You have a fascinating background in research profile, so I'd like to get into a bit of your background before we dig into your paper, Religion Without Romance. The first thing I got to ask is, what the heck were you doing writing a paper on gazelles and gazillas in China and India for the U.S. International Trade Commission? I mean, are we involved in some kind of trade war over Asian deer? And more importantly, what is a gazilla? Is that one of those radioactive lizards that smashes Tokyo?
It's a really big Asian deer. No. Gazelles and Gazillas was a paper that I worked with Michael Farentino and some other co-authors with when I was working with the International Trade Commission. The idea is that there are firms that grow more rapidly than normal over time. So we looked at firms that double over a four-year period in terms of revenues. And so any firm that doubles over that type of an interval is considered a gazelle. And what we found was that in China and India, it wasn't so much gazelles per se, which would include small and medium-sized enterprises, but it was gazillas that were really leaping and growing very quickly over the time period that we investigated. There was a lot of fuss and bother over the word gazilla because of copyright issues, but it was a fun paper to work on. It was an opportunity for me to really learn my chops on econometrics and data cleaning. And Michael Farentino has been a great friend and mentor to me. So I'm really proud of that work and glad that I had the opportunity to do that.
So the gazelles and gazillas is just a metaphor for these businesses?
That's right, the firms that grow quickly.
Okay. And what was the copyright issue over gazilla? Does somebody own the word gazilla?
No, but anytime you get close to a certain Asian lizard, people get upset.
Okay. Wow. So really, somebody contacted you and say, no, that sounds too much like Godzilla. You can't put that in there.
I think legal got a hold of it first and took care of that.
Okay. Yeah, they're good at that bureaucracy. That is just wild. You know, given your interest in Godzillas and also your interest in religion, you should write a paper called Godzilla. It would just really kind of bring your research agenda full circle, I guess.
Yeah. Sounds great.
Your intersection of graduate studies and research interests, public choice theory and religion, happens to be one of mine that I had in graduate school, though I didn't dive as deeply into the formal world of public choice as you are doing. I'm starting to revisit some of that right now, which is really enjoyable, and it's great to have you on the show doing this. For those folks in our listening audience who are not familiar with this field of economics, what is public choice theory?
Public choice comes out of the mainline field of economics that treats individuals as the actor. And this is, you know, I've seen this in your work. It comes mostly through the godfathers of James Buchanan and Gordon Tullock. The idea is that political actors are people too, that they have their own self-interest in mind when they are making policy. So instead of presuming a beneficent dictator or ruler, it says, let's look at the incentives that the decision makers face and think about what kind of exchanges those decision makers are going to engage in amongst one another and also with the general population in order to achieve their own individual ends. So, you know, ideas like the median voter theorem, which says that the decisive voter is going to be the voter who falls in the middle of a lineup of voters. That idea comes out strongly in the public choice way of thinking. Public choice also takes a strong look at regulation and how regulation is drawn up, and it is consistent application of what's called methodological individualism, which is the idea that the individual is the unit of analysis, and it's also an extension of an idea called analytical egalitarianism, which my own advisor, David Levy, has highlighted in his work with Sandra Peart, which says that if we treat all individuals as endogenous to the system that is under analysis, we end up getting better results than by treating as an expert oneself as exogenous to the system. That is, an expert who approaches a problem but brings to that problem an end that they have identified of their own instead of trying to identify the ends of the people within the system is going to arrive at perhaps an impossible conclusion. And at least the mode of analysis is going to be weak and likely to come to false conclusions.
Yeah, that is a really good point. And I remind my graduate students and undergraduate students that any theory that we can create as political scientists, as economists, has to apply to us as well. And I guess that's kind of the spirit of analytical egalitarianism.
And that comes out of the work of Frank Knight, but it's also found all the way back in Adam Smith.
Yeah. No, that's true. As us being the impartial observer and stepping into the situations to understand the folks that are participating in it. Yes, very cool. So public choice theory, it's a really cool theory, and I enjoy reading it in graduate school and teaching it now as a in courses for graduate students and undergraduate students. But it's kind of odd to connect public choice theory to the study of religion. And I have to ask all my economists who I have on the show, and there are a number of them, how you ever became interested in religion, and then how did you connect it with public choice theory?
Well, as is probably more common than not, you know, I grew up in evangelicalism. I have an intimate relationship with it. I worked as a missionary for 8 years in downtown Durham, North Carolina, working with low-income, no-income students. And it was always interesting to me the connections within evangelicalism. I was an analytical thinker from my childhood, and I noticed connections in doctrine and in behavior that didn't always make sense to me. And I was curious about it. So as I was a teacher at this small boarding school, one day they handed me a book on economics and said, here, teach this to the kids. And I had never been exposed to economics before. I started studying, started learning, and decided, oh, I want to do this for the rest of my life. So I went on to graduate school. In graduate school, I came to George Mason University, you know, initially planning to study industrial organization and perhaps a bit of Austrian economics, not having much background at all in public choice. But as I got involved, you know, I noticed that public choice was a comparative advantage for Mason, and I also found that it really helped me to understand the world in a much better way, a much more tractable way. I wasn't planning on going into the economics of religion. I came to that sort of as a when I was searching for a dissertation topic. I took a course taught by David Levy on constitutional political economy, and he told a joke one day. Well, it wasn't a joke. He mentioned in class one day a book written by Jeremy Bentham and the co-author, but it was called Not Paul but Jesus, and they wrote this under a pseudonym. The pseudonym was Gamaliel Smith. And when Dr. Levy said the words Gamaliel Smith, I laughed out loud, and I was the only one in the room who did laugh out loud. Gamaliel being the name of Paul's teacher, the Pharisee, and Smith being the last name of Adam Smith. At that moment, I knew that I was going to write under David Levy. And then as we talked more and more, we got into discussions about the economics of religion, and that came a long, varied path, but I felt like I had something to offer that was peculiar and an insight, and that's how I wound up where I am.
I love that story. There's a lot of fortuitous events that occur, or possibly providence in the making, and from that book that you read at Agape Boarding School to the joke or offhanded comment that David Levy says kind of puts you on this path. And we oftentimes think we have these grand plans that are of our own design, but we just kind of fall into different places. I have a question on that book that you read at Agape. Do you remember what that book was? It wasn't Paul Samuelson's textbook, was it?
Well, you know, we tried that at first, but the diagrams were a bit tough.
Yeah. No.
And the production possibility frontier explanation doesn't really make any sense. But when it was a book by Richard Mayberry, who's called who calls himself Uncle Eric, and it's called Whatever Happens to Penny Candy. And he's a bit of a quack, but it got me on the road.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's kind of cool. And again, too, the mention of Gamaliel Smith. I don't know how many people would know that Paul's teacher was Gamaliel, which is kind of odd, right? I wouldn't know that. I can't remember that. So yeah, it's good that you were a missionary, and that's why we have folks like you on this show here. So you go into writing this dissertation, and you're, first of all, explain to us the dissertation process in economics. It's a little bit different than other places, and it might be different at GMU, too. I'm not quite sure. But a lot of economists do these three papers that they have to write for a dissertation. What is your dissertation looking like, and what's the defense going to look like?
That's right. In economics, the dissertation is often three papers in search of a theme. And sometimes the theme is there's a staple attaching the three together. But this dissertation was not the original idea. I was originally going to look at contraceptives and the adoption of contraceptives by religious groups in the United States after the first religious group to adopt contraceptives, being the Anglican Church, happened in 1930. That's sort of on the back burner for right now, but that time period is still important to what I'm working on. The first paper is this paper broadly outlining the Evangelical Coalition and applying a public choice lens to what the Evangelical Coalition is, what it's been, what it may turn out to be in the future. And that was just a paper that I couldn't not write. I couldn't progress on my other topics until this paper had taken some sort of a concrete form, and until I had been forced through the process of writing to think more carefully about the themes and issues going on there, and getting feedback on my ideas there. The other chapters in my dissertation are going to include an analysis of data that has also been looked at by Rodney Stark and Roger Finke, the U.S. Census of Religious Bodies, taken between 1896 and 1946. And that data includes lots of information about demographics, about the ages of people who are attending churches. It includes information about the value of church properties, the revenues of the churches, the amount of debt still owed on church and churches and parishes. But it also includes a statement of history, a statement of polity, a statement of doctrine, and a statement of works crafted by the respondents to the census themselves. So here we have an objective measure of which doctrines each religious body in the United States, and it's taken at the denominational level, espoused at a particular point in time. And the research there will investigate the responsiveness of denominations to social changes, and I will include and create variables related to polity and doctrine and works that come out of those statements. So I'm doing textual analysis, doing word searches and word counts to explore the emphases that each denomination places. And then I'm also including polity, form of polity as a variable in that analysis. So, and polity is interesting because even within theological circles, there does not yet exist a comparative institutional analysis of the different forms of polity that religious denominations take, or at least not to my knowledge. And most pastors, when they go get their training, if they learn anything about polity at all, they only learn the polity of their own denomination and very rarely learn anything about alternative forms of polity. And that becomes important, particularly when there are schisms or when particular congregations move in between denominations. My own congregation where I attend now is considering a move to a different denomination, and I emailed my pastor and said, did you consider that the new denomination that we're considering moving to might include more members on the elder board, or might assign a different level of decision-making power to the pastor, and that the change in decision-making power might influence which denomination our congregation chooses to move to, or at least the leadership within our congregation chooses to move to. And, of course, nobody had thought about that at all. But that's the application, again, of methodological individualism, of considering each person as just as likely to make a mistake as anybody else, to a concrete example.
That is a really cool project, and we're going to have you back when you flesh that out some more, because I do agree with you that very little research has been conducted on the polity or the organizational structures of different denominations in a comparative way, especially done through an economic framework. So that is really neat, and you're using a really cool data set that can probably tell us a lot of stuff and hasn't been analyzed that way before. So we'll get you back on that. Let's move into your paper now, Religion Without Romance. And I want to know how you came up with that particular topic. You already gave us some sense of how your background flooded into this and how you were working on a different paper on contraception. But tell us a little bit about where the topic idea came from and also how you named the paper Religion Without Romance.
I have to give full credit to Peter Becky there. At my dissertation defense, I defended the idea of the issue of contraception, and since then, as many dissertations do, it's changed direction a good bit. It was he who pulled that out, and that phrase comes from James Buchanan, who talks about politics without romance, which is public choice. And what I'm actually doing in my work is religion without romance, presuming that religion is a human institution, and that we ought not to presume benevolent motives on the part of people who are involved. We can presume sincere motives, but sometimes the very process of collective decision-making results in unintended consequences. And so that's how I came to that particular title. And it's really catchy. And David Levy also recommended that I grab a hold of public choice political theology and get that written before somebody else came up with it, although the chances of that seem to be pretty slim.
No, I think you probably, I mean, the critics of public choice theory always call it a theology, but no, you, I think getting that term into your lexicon and copywriting it just like Godzilla's is a wise idea. And I love how Pete Betke, I know well, and his writing is fantastic. So this is a dissertation that really is formed by the folks around you at George Mason University. You're in a unique intellectual environment and just such a cool topic. And the religion without romance topic is really good. And it, as I teach religion and politics classes, I get a lot of people that think, well, you know, once you step into the religious world, it's everything is just, you know, economics is suspended and people just pray for things. And if they're pure of heart, then manna falls from the sky and everything's great. But as I remind them, hey, these are human institutions with people who have failings and people who have different motivations. And that's what public choice theory is telling us about. So give us the general precis of your paper, and then we'll dig into it bit by bit.
The idea is that the evangelical coalition, which, you know, is a really hard thing to define, right? Nobody really knows how to put a circle around the evangelical coalition and give it a real name. And that's true of historians of theology and of evangelicalism as much as anybody else. I'm going to cite Mark Knoll, who is one of the foremost historians of evangelicalism, and he says the term evangelicalism is a wide-reaching definitional canopy that covers a diverse number of Protestant traditions, denominations, organizations, and churches. But then he also says all efforts to describe evangelicalism, whether historically or doctrinally, must fail. For the evangelical impulses of the last 2.5 centuries have been extraordinarily diverse, variegate beyond imagination, and constantly engaged in a division, recombination, and reformation. And that comes from the introduction to a book by Tidball on evangelicalism and the history of it. And Tidball compares evangelicalism to a Rubik's Cube puzzle of multiple dimensions of thought, of issues that contribute to it. So I'm looking at this thing, evangelicalism, and I'm hearing from all around me and all the history that I read about it and in the popular media discussions about evangelicalism, but nobody can put their finger on it. And I say, well, why can't anybody really boil this down and explain to me what it is? And so I say, I have to find out what this really means. And so the idea came to me that, well, it seems to me that evangelicalism is often involved in politics. That's when you hear about it the most in the public anyway.
Yeah, there's this big... Yeah, I was going to say there's this... Yeah, I was going to say that there's this big, huge voting block called the Evangelical Coalition, like it's a very well-defined monster thing running through the election system.
Right. And so as a voting block and as a public choice economist, I say, oh, okay, voting blocks have particular goals. Specifically, they want to try to capture the median voter. And again, this median voter is important because whoever can surround that median voter can have influence on politics and can have a bigger say in what the national secular political mechanisms do. So that was easy enough to explain why evangelicalism exists as a bloc, but to try to understand why evangelicalism is hard to put a finger on and make a definition for, I looked back to the study of voting chaos that comes out of the work of Charles Plott and other public choice economists that describe a system where you have more than one dimension along which voters are making their decisions. So in the broad secular political sphere, most public choice economics shows that can typically be described as a single dimension, which we typically describe as liberal to conservative, or left to right, or Democrat to Republican. And that's a single-dimensional spectrum. And to find a median voter in that single-dimensional spectrum, given a bunch of assumptions, is usually easy to identify at least a range over which that median voter will lie. But when you add another dimension, even when you just move to two dimensions, when it's not just how much money, for example, is going to be spent on public goods, but if you add another dimension, then things become complicated. And to look at the Evangelical Coalition, it seems clear to me, anyhow, that there are multiple dimensions, and this is consistent with what Tidball has said, that there are issues about end times beliefs, there's issues about how people are assured of eternal salvation, there's issues about how churches get organized, there's questions about the sacraments and paedobaptism versus adult baptism. All of these different issues can be identified as possible different dimensions on which people will place their preferences. And if we were to look at the broad spectrum of Christian denominations in America today, it would be a scatterplot all over the place of these different preferences. They don't always line up systematically. Well, when you've got a system like that, when there's multiple dimensions, what we observe is chaos within that coalition. And the reason that happens is that it's really hard for even just three individual groups to find a point of agreement that all three can agree on and will stick to and share control over the decision-making equally. Each individual group is going to want to have a greater influence directly over the secular political spectrum. And so what they're going to want to do is they're going to want to build an internal coalition among groups that would want to have influence, and they want to build that in such a way that they have more power than any of the other groups over what happens. So, for example, in my paper I talk about three different groups. I call them the Adventists, the Baptists, and the Calvinists, just for the simplicity of using A, B, and C. And it's possible, for example, that the Baptists and the Calvinists could build a coalition that leaves the Adventists out completely. And they can build this coalition on any number of a wide variety of margins of agreement. And they can say, okay, together we're going to build a coalition, we're going to sort of push the Adventists out, and then we will each have more influence over secular politics than if we had to share some of that influence with the Adventists. And that's fine. But whenever that happens, it's possible for the Adventists to come back and to offer a position either to the Baptists or the Calvinists that is more favorable to the other group, but that is also more favorable to themselves. So they can pull either the Baptists or the Calvinists away from the existing coalition, offer them something extra, and build a new coalition over which the Adventists have more say. Well, then after that happens, the Calvinists can come back and make an offer, either to the Adventists or the Baptists. Again, you know, there's this cycling. There's this chaos that occurs within the possible coalition. And so my hypothesis here is that this is what's happening inside of evangelicalism, that it's competition for control over the agenda of the overall evangelical coalition that results in our observance of what seems to be a very tumultuous coalition.
Yeah, and that's going to play a huge impact here in 2016 in the current election cycle, and you're going to have some thoughts on that here in a minute. One of the things that you mentioned in your paper earlier on is that as the Democratic franchise expands, direct influence of religion over state decision decreases. And this is going to become important because it leads to elections and it leads to voters having potentially more influence. And if there's chaos within the coalition, it creates a lot of interesting outcomes. So explain what you mean by as the Democratic franchise expands, direct influence of religion over state decisions decreases?
So if we look back to the era before the Reformation, the Roman Catholic Church exerted a lot of influence over European politics. And this is present in the works of Adam Smith, that the Catholic Church basically operated like a standing army present in each of those different European countries that disciplined the behavior of that ruler over that particular country. And that ruler had to look to the Catholic Church to give it legitimacy, to give him or her legitimacy to rule. What is it that enables a ruler to exert power over its people? It's the idea that the people believe the ruler has legitimacy to rule. And so Smith was kind of contrasting and providing a different approach to thinking about this than the popular, or at least today considered the popular, way of thinking about that provided by Hobbes, where the ruler rules almost kind of by necessity. What Smith noticed and what I'm pointing out here is that as legitimacy comes from the church, what happens when the church itself loses its legitimacy? So the Catholic Church got involved, at least in different places at different times, in all kinds of abuses. And Smith says this is going to happen whenever you have a monopoly religion and power. So when there were those abuses, the people themselves would place less trust in the word of the church, in the church's assignment of legitimacy. So by the time that Henry VIII, for example, in England, decides that he wants to divorce his wife, and in order to do so, he breaks his ties with Rome, Henry VIII already was in a position where making a break with Rome was possible because of the abuses that were present in Catholicism in Great Britain at the time. Just look at Cardinal Wolsey and the fact that he had a bigger house than the king did. The church had the ability to collect rents from the people who lived on its land, but then also tithes from people who didn't live on the land. And so they were able to capture all kinds of wealth. Well, just as the rulers of the bygone era had to give up, didn't have to, but as merchant traffic increased, as commerce increased, rulers and wealthy people stopped receiving their wealth in kind, in terms of food and wool, and started receiving their wealth in terms of money. Well, noblemen and landowners of the time stopped using that income that was in kind to feed the people of their area, and the church stopped using those tithes to take care of the poor, and instead started using that wealth to make their own lives more luxurious. Adam Smith gives the example of a ruler or of a nobleman buying a diamond-encrusted, I think it's a belt buckle. And so the abuses of the church grow. Then the church loses its ability to lend legitimacy. Henry VIII can make a break from Rome, but he still needs to find a way to get some legitimacy from somewhere, and he ends up looking to Parliament to give him that legitimacy, and the Parliament ends up giving him a limited amount of legitimacy in order to rule. They must have been ready for the break with Rome as well, otherwise they wouldn't have done it. And from then on, as the Parliament becomes the place where the monarch or the ruler gets its power, as the Parliament more and more derives its power from the voting franchise, from those who can vote, as the franchise is extended, then the power of the church continues to decrease. Now, I take the next step and say, okay, the church has lost influence over government. How can the church get influence again? The church is going to want that influence. Their motives haven't changed. And my claim is that as groups each individually work to try to gain influence over politics, a coalition emerges among them. And in Great Britain and in the United States, that coalition Maybe it's because of the kind of democracy that we are. But that coalition looks like in today is called the Evangelical Coalition.
Yeah, and you talk about this, too, in terms of different types of religious markets. So the church is trying to regain its influence in politics, and it's going to have to run through parliament now. And if it was just a single church, well, then it's not that big a deal. But once you start to see pluralism there, this is where you start to get into what we were talking about before, building coalitions and the voting cast. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And I don't, this is not exactly present in Adam Smith's work. You know, I try to build in my paper a taxonomy of the economics of religion and what Adam Smith has to say about monopoly religion in a particular setting, and what Adam Smith has to say about competitive religion in a different setting. And he was observing the growth of competitive religion in Great Britain at the time and in Scotland, and he saw it as a good thing. He saw it as a good thing primarily because it reduced the price of religion. That's maybe a funny way of talking about it, but Gary Anderson has called it the quality of religion, and I call it the price because when a church is a monopoly, it has control over the entire market for religion. We know that monopolies tend to decrease the provision of services and goods and to raise the price of those goods and services in order to capture extra rents, extra wealth for themselves. Well, when you get to a competitive situation, the prices fall and provision increases. Adam Smith thought that the price of religion would fall to what he called rational religion, which is something consistent with what he saw Hume wanting, an absence of fanaticism in the beliefs of religious people. He thought that would lead to a good society, that it would be a strong foundation for good morals within society. So my claim is that when you have a lot of competitive religions, that is the best scenario. But then those competitive religions still are going to want to have influence over government. They're going to be rent seekers just like everybody else. And Smith says, seldom does any group of industrialists or merchants or manufacturers get together in a room together, except that they conspire to limit the amount of trade. In other words, that they conspire to act as a cartel to capture more rents. So how is it that religions conspire to raise the price of religion? And what is the motivation there? The motivation is that they want to have access and influence over government. The process is to get together and build a coalition, to work together. And I claim that all this happens primarily informally. There are a lot of groups that, parachurch organizations that form as evangelicalism grows, where that kind of opportunity for colluding and talking together will occur. And a lot of this happens through talk. So as evangelicalism grows, we see this happening, this colluding happening. Now, I'm going to make one other claim here, and that is that before the era of the Wesleyan revival in Great Britain, church clerics tended to be somewhat isolated. Religious groups would be dispersed across the country in relatively isolated locations. A lot of pastors and ministers were relatively uninterested in doing more than just earning a living from their position. And a lot of that was provided through the government or through the protection of the ability to collect tithes. But then with the Wesleyans and with Whitfield and the rise of the Methodist movement, we have a unique, peculiar thing happening, and that is itinerant preaching. We have ministers riding around on horseback, preaching every day of the week in every town that they come to, and going all throughout the entire country, town by town, preaching in public, 3-4 times a day. This talking that occurs, this preaching throughout the land, I claim is one way that a coalition is able to form, that because people are being pulled away from their local congregations and detracted by this itinerant preaching, the clerics in those locations have to respond in some way. And so there's more conversation between, among, and across the various churches within the Church of England and the dissenting churches. Shortly after the Wesleyan movement started in the 1730s, 1740s, by the 1800s, we see the first big evangelical movement, the first big push of evangelicalism, and that is famously described in many works as the work of William Wilberforce and the Clapham sect involved in trying to achieve the abolition of slavery.
Okay. This is, I have to pause a minute and just compliment you on what you do in your paper with Adam Smith and linking all of this to public choice theory, because if those of you who are familiar with Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, it's a very large book, and by the time you get to his more explicit discussion of religion in Book 5, you've long forgot about what happened in Book 1, but you link back to that great quote about merchants getting together to conspire against the interests of the public and raise prices. You know, they don't gather for merriment or diversion, but the discussion often leads to collusion to raise prices. It's a great quote, and few people make that linkage, and for you to draw that line from Book 5 all the way back to Book 1 is just absolutely brilliant, because religions are interest groups, and they're going to want to get involved in things. And so one of the other things that your paper does is to document how this happens throughout American history. Now, you just left off here with the Wesleyan revival and how it comes to America and the movement toward abolitionism through William Wilberforce in Britain, and then through a bunch of other groups here in the United States. In your paper, you talk about how this coalition moves throughout time through what you call five shifts. Give us a history of the evangelical coalition involved in political interest group politics from that point on.
So we go back to abolitionism, and there is the evangelical movement there. It sort of forms in that time period, I claim anyway. And then after that, we have time periods of growth, of change. In America, after the Constitution is signed, there is a reduction of the regulation on religion, which allows for the Methodists and the Baptists to move all throughout America, sharing their message. It's not until later that this really frees up in New England. The coalitions form later. We see in movements for, well, there's issues about the that are continued of abolition in the Civil War era, and there's movements amongst the groups there. And then when we get to the post-World War I era, and we look at the 1920s, there's a division within evangelicalism that pushes some folks towards fundamentalism and some folks towards progressivism. And typically, the historian of evangelicalism will go along with the fundamentalist line and claim that the progressives, the mainline denominations, at that point are no longer a part of evangelicalism. My claim is, why? Why would you say that? Have the progressive groups wanted to have any less influence over government than they had before? As a matter of fact, no. They want to have even more influence than they've had in the past. So we come to issues like prohibition and the temperance movements. We come to issues like the issues about contraceptives. And those issues are split in large part over the way that the different groups understand the role of science, and in particular Darwinism and evolutionism. And we see a split there, that those who can find a way to make their theology work with evolution and those who can't split. Now, I say that it's not so much about evolutionism. I'm going to go along the line with David Levy here and say that it's about the approach that we take to understanding the world. It's about whether or not we are looking at the world as an exogenous analyst or whether we are considering ourselves endogenous to the problem. And when we get to this progressive era, we have folks who are treating themselves as experts, saying that they know what society can and should look like, and that they have a design, a plan for getting us there. Whereas the fundamentalists are suspicious of that expertise-ism and are suspicious in part because it comes from the same line of teaching that came out of Germany about critical analysis of Scripture. And they want to hold on to a strict reading of Scripture. And so we get this break where some people are interested in influencing culture and society directly through government, and some people are resistant to that. So there's this split and a churning within evangelicalism at that time. And it's interesting because if you look at this time period and what's happening there, the people who are in society are intentionally trying to make this division. Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, intentionally pulls the mainline denominations away from the rest of Christian Protestantism at the time and tries to get them to be more for the use of contraceptives at the time. And she does this in part because she wants to push Catholics in particular out of the ability to make decisions. This comes to a head in the 1928 election of Herbert Hoover, and the person he ran against was Al Smith, a Catholic from New York. There's political consequences to the way that the coalition is formed and who is in and who is out. It's interesting, if you look at the Deep South counties from that election, a lot of the Deep South fundamentalist counties voted with the Catholics against Herbert Hoover and for Al Smith. So that's a second great example of this all happening.
How does this then progress throughout time? Because this is a fascinating period, right? And what you are finding and discovering here is that this isn't just something that happens, people just changing their minds. There's movements here. There's people talking to one another and influencing one another, saying, hey, distance yourself from this group, join our group, and trying to figure out where that median voter is in order to get the greatest amount of influence. So what happens after this? How does the coalition reform, change, alter itself?
Well, I think that what happens is that silence is just as important as noise in economic analysis. What we see is that after World War II, we have a period of relative silence within evangelicalism, that there's not a lot of churn. And I would claim that what's happening there is that evangelicalism has captured dominance over the political process. In other words, we've achieved something like what we might call peak Christendom, where the folks who are interested in influencing culture have that influence. And we see this in personalities like Billy Graham, who had a door to the White House open to him almost constantly from the 50s all the way through. Even today, if he wanted to, I'm sure he could get a meeting with Barack Obama. maybe not his son, but Billy probably could. So this position of dominance leads to relative quiet because there's a stable equilibrium. Everybody is kind of getting what they want, and there's not as much churn. Now, we see evangelicalism come up again in the 1970s. With the election of Jimmy Carter and issues surrounding abortion and sexual freedom. Stanley Hauerwas, a theologian down at Duke University, claims that Christendom started to die in 1969, the summer of 69, when he and his buddies snuck out of church to go see a movie. And this is when Christendom starts to lose its power hold over American politics, and other groups start to get involved. And so around this same time period, we see the emergence of groups like Sojourners, We see led by Jim Wallace, and we see writing by folks like Ron Sider, and a move back in the progressive direction. And these folks claim to be evangelicals. They call themselves evangelicals. And what they see is they're trying to capture some sort of a voice within that evangelical coalition so that they can increase the influence that they have over politics. And they're very explicit that their goals are related to politics. So as time moves on, we see a shifting of what evangelicalism is called, who claims to be a part of it, and also how important it is to be called an evangelical. So that's roughly the outline of what I see in history. We maybe reached peak evangelicalism under George Bush II, where he was very vocal about being evangelical. He was very much involved in including evangelicals in his planning. His ideas of compassionate conservatism were very much related to that. And so that seems to be a period of peak evangelicalism. Evangelicalism, again, enters into a crisis with the election of Barack Obama. And people believe that at that point something has gone terribly wrong within the coalition. And I think that in part what we've arrived at is beyond just post-Christian dumb, we've also reached post-evangelicalism to a certain point. It's starting to lose its influence. I expect that we'll see more churn and more fighting over what it means to be an evangelical from here, and at least until the end of the election and into the near future.
Yeah, this is a great analysis, because today, we're in releasing this in the middle of March. We're actually recording this late February, and we just finished the Nevada caucuses and Nevada primaries. And lots of people are talking about, who did the evangelical vote with? Did they vote with Trump? Did they vote with Cruz? Did they vote with Hillary or whoever it might be? And the pundits come at it in a very temporal sense. And your perspective here, looking at this churning of the coalition over time, who comes in and who doesn't, really gives us some kind of perspective that, to say that there's this block of reified evangelical voters that only vote in one way and they're going to choose this candidate or that candidate is not really the case. You're pointing out that we are going through a moment of voting chaos, and the coalition is shifting. It's confused for a lot of individuals, and we're not sure what we're going to see. And so to move forward on this would only be reckless speculation of what's going to happen in 2016. And if there's anything that we like to do at Research on Religion, it is engage in reckless speculation. So this is not in your paper, and we're not going to hold you to anything here, because, again, as I mentioned, we're recording in late February, and who knows what will happen in the next several months. But looking at your paper and this evangelical coalition and seeing how it's starting to change in the 1970s, you get peak evangelicalism under George Bush, starting to shift under Barack Obama. What is going on? I mean, people are debating, do the evangelicals come and kiss Donald Trump, or are they jumping on Cruz? What's going on?
So I want to preface by saying that the success of the evangelical coalition is not predicated upon winning elections, right? Because the evangelical coalition consists of a block of voters that surrounds a median voter, or at least that's what they're trying to do. So what they primarily are concerned about is influencing the platform of the politicians. And they're going to influence both the politicians on the left and on the right, because they're all going to want to move towards where the median voter is in order to ensure capturing the election. As long as evangelicals have a stable hold over that middle, they're going to be happy. Whether or not they have a hold over that right now, we don't know. In the primaries, I'm going to claim that, and this is speculation, that the primaries are a season of testing by evangelicals to see whether or not a candidate can move towards the middle where they want them. The best analysis of the current election that I've seen thus far is a chart that Pew put out the other day that showed where each of the different denominations were split, what the composition of each of the denominations was between Republicans and Democrats. And evangelicals do trend more towards the Republican on that. But in no case are they the dominant group. Is it unilateral? But then there's also the question of who Pew is counting as evangelical. And there's all these other religious groups that tend to be more democratic. And I would claim that actually, if we think about the evangelical coalition as this movement to control the center, a lot of those groups ought to be included as evangelicals. Maybe a way to say, to define evangelicalism is to say it's that group of religious organizations that wants to have an influence over politics by trying to capture the median voter. So I've seen analysis by Matthew McWilliams on Vox, and he shows that Trump has won roughly a third of the evangelicals. But evangelicalism is kind of an empty term at that point. And what he says is that Trump is winning the authoritarians, people who want, who trend authoritarian in their own position. And so he finds direct correlation between authoritarianism and Trump. What's interesting to the listeners of this show is that religiosity, that is the number of times that people typically go to worship services, is an inverse correlation with voting for Trump. So religiosity predicts that folks won't vote for him. My claim is that the evangelical is about trying to capture the median voter, and so it's uncorrelated with Trump or with any other particular candidate, at least at this point. The other part about the primaries is that during the primary season, and this is consistent with public choice analysis, is that voters aren't trying to move to the middle yet. They're actually trying to pull candidates to the extremes because there's no necessary move to the direct media. And so we see a lot more diversity in positions that candidates take during the primary season. Once we get to the general election, we'll see everybody, whomever the candidates are, make a quick move towards the middle.
Fascinating things to look at here. And you put it in a great deal of broader context, and which is, for many people who are anxious about the upcoming election and worried about all sorts of different things, which you can constantly get on the media, your perspective actually tempers this quite a bit and sees it in a larger historical process and in an analytical process. I think your point that what evangelicals are trying to do is capture that median voter, or some people might say capture the political culture amongst themselves, is a really nice way to think about this. Let me go ahead and just ask a more general question. As you mentioned earlier in the podcast with your biography, you worked at this boarding school for a while, and then you were asked to teach economics, handed a book, and that put you on this journey, which has led through your dissertation and the paper that you're writing here. Do a little bit of reflection backwards, and through that whole process, is there anything that has really surprised you along the way that you look backwards and you go, you know, I would have never thought about it that way, or I really changed my mind on something? How have you transformed in the process of doing this research?
Well, that's a great question, and it's consistent with the kind of question that Russ Roberts is asking a lot of his guests lately about, you know, what is it that you've come across that's caused you to change your priors on anything? Is economics really good for anything except for confirming your priors? I started out as much more of a conservative, much more of an evangelical, and I've moved away from that, and I've become more critical of what I see politicians doing, and also of what I see, you know, folks in the church doing. I still love the church because Jesus loves his church, but I want to see the purity of that, and I hope that I'm not poking people in the eye, but that I am identifying things that we ought to be careful about. You know, it's the economist's job to stand in the back of the room and ask, how much is this going to cost when an idea is being proposed? And to raise a question in the context of religion, the question is, how much of a compromise are we having to make on our values, on our principles, on our concern for liberty, on our concern for the poor? What are the relevant trade-offs? Because economics is the study of exchange, and it's the study of exchange when there are real opportunity costs and trade-offs to what we're trying to do. And bringing those questions to any context is relevant. So I think that's where I stand now.
Well, that is a really good insight and one that I have shared as well, examining public choice theory and understanding that not only are politicians real people, but people within religious institutions are real people as well. And those I think we can share with our listeners, and hopefully they will take some of those things forward. My guest today has been Nathaniel Snow. Nathaniel, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.